The old guard Verus was dead, and Aulis. Every one of the young men who had been my suitors was dead. My mother was dead. Almost every household in Latium grieved for a father or brother or son, killed or crippled. I think one cannot be left alive among so many deaths without feeling unendurable shame. They say Mars absolves the warrior from the crimes of war, but those who were not the warriors, those for whom the war was said to be fought, even though they never wanted it to be fought, who absolves them? In the evening of the day of my mother's funeral, I called Maruna, Sicana, and others of the chief women of the Regia to come with me. Old Vestina was too broken with grief to do anything but crouch on the floor in my mother's room and rock herself, crying without tears, making a little moaning like a sick child. We walked down through the streets to the altar of Janus, where I made offering of meal and incense to the power of beginning and ending. People of the city gathered round. No one spoke. The silence of the city after the noise of war brought awe into us all. In our loss and fear, we craved the acts of religion, the ceremonies that allow us to admit our helplessness, our dependence on the great forces we do not understand. When I had made the offering to Janus, I went, followed by my women and many people, to the doors that stood ajar in their high cedar frame nearby, the war gate, the gate that led nowhere whether it was open or shut. I pushed at one of the doors, then the other. I could not move them. Standing open, they had sagged from their hinges and rested on the stony ground. My women helped me, and men came forward to join us. We finally forced the gates shut, and Sicana and one of the men lifted up the squared beam of oak and slotted it through the thick iron staples of the lock. Then I spoke to the gate. "Stay shut! The treaty holds!" I felt as if I were speaking to an enemy, defeated for the moment, but never anything but an enemy. The people murmured after me, "The treaty holds." Aeneas did not come to Laurentum for 9 days, the period of mourning. This was simple decency. Coming sooner, he would be perceived and resented as the conqueror enforcing his triumph. No matter that he had sworn to leave the crown and the sword to Latinus and bring only his gods to Latium, we had seen that promise twice broken in the making. Still, "The new king's in no hurry to come, is he?" people said. Even my women called him that, though I told them it was disrespectful to our true king. Word got round that the Trojan had been wounded and needed to recover, and people said with some satisfaction, "So Turnus nicked him after all." Yet they told with admiration how he had hunted Turnus across the battlefield for 2 hours with an arrowhead in the muscle of his thigh. When he did come, he walked lame and looked rather drawn and gaunt. He sent a messenger ahead to prepare us, and arrived with a troop of only 10 or 12 men, all mounted, dressed in what finery they had, their armor mostly, cleaned up and polished, and maybe a cloak or tunic that had been handsome before the long voyage from Troy. A couple of splendid Etruscan princes were with them, but none of the Greeks. In grief and bitterness of heart at his son's death, Evander had called all his men back to Pelantium. Aeneas rode a horse that had been one of my father's gifts to him at the very outset, that day when the first treaty was made, when I was promised to him. The fine dun stallion, well trained but lively, scented his old friends the mares in the royal stables as he passed, and set up a lot of whinnying, which of course the mares answered with neighs and squeals. So that part of their entrance was fairly noisy. The guard stood aside for them at the gates of Laurentum, and they rode quietly up the Via Regia. People came running to look and crowded on the roofs, but they too were quiet. The men dismounted at the house door. I hurried down from my spy post above the door and came round to enter the council chamber from the back. But Gaius, who had taken over Vera's position as chief of the king's guards, stopped me at the doorway. "The king says please to wait until you are sent for, queen," he said. He was the first to call me that. I am not sure he knew what he was saying. He was a silent, shy, grave old man, embarrassed at having to stop me. So I had to wait at the doorway, unable to hear most of what they were saying. My father was on his cross-legged throne. I could see his back and several Trojans, but not Aeneas. There was some speech-making. The Etruscan, Tarchon, asked Latinus pardon for bringing his men to fight against the Latins, explaining that the people of Kyri had resolved to take the tyrant Mezentius from Turnus in Aerdia to punish him as he deserved. But an oracle told them they must have a foreign leader for such an expedition, and Aeneas had turned up at exactly the right moment. Latinus accepted this apology as gracefully as it was offered. He wanted no quarrel with Etruria. Drances did a great deal of the talking. He had been utterly odious to me since Turnus' death. There was no reason in it, but I could not help it, and I clenched my fists in loathing as he droned on. Then one of the Trojans said something, and an Etruscan answered, and everyone laughed, which changed the mood, and I heard a quiet, resonant voice.
"I bring a gift for your daughter, King Latinus." "That is most gracious, noble Aeneas," my father said. "And she will bring to you a dowry worthy of our wealth and pride." "I have no doubt of that, my king. But what I bring, I wish to give her with my own hands."
My father nodded and said to Cisus, who was attending him as page,
"Send for my daughter, Lavinia."
Cisus was just turning to fetch me as I came forward with Gaius. I arrived with unseemly speed. My father looked a little startled. At last I could see Aeneas. He had been hidden from me before because he was seated. My father had had a folding stool brought for him, since he was still lame. But he stood up as soon as he saw me, and we looked at each other at eye level. He was much taller than I, but I was up on the dais. Seeing him made me happy. It brought me joy. I thought I saw a gleam, a reflection of my pleasure in his face. We bowed our heads in formal greeting, and then a dark man with a keen, kind face, Achates, brought a big pottery vessel up to the dais and rested it there. It was made of heavy red clay, undecorated, broad at the bottom, broad-shouldered, with a sealed stopper. Aeneas put his hands on it, large, scarred hands, with a formality of gesture that came naturally to him, and also with a kind of affectionate tenderness.
"Lavinia," he said, "when I left Troy, I could not bring much with me. My father and my son, some of my people, and the gods of my household and my ancestors. My father is with the lords of the underworld. My son Ascanius stands there, and with him are my people, ready to do you honor as his mother and their queen. And my Penates and the sacred things of my ancestors, I give you now to keep and cherish on the altars of our house, in the city that will bear your name. They have come a long way to your hearth and heart."
I knelt down and put my hands on the vessel too. I said, "I will keep and cherish them," in a thin voice.
"Where shall we build Lavinium?"
he said, energetic, smiling now with open pleasure, looking from me to Latinus.
"We must go about the country and see what will suit best."
My father said,
"I thought of a region in the foothills up near the Father River. Good growing land and good timber above it."
"Down the coast," I said. My voice was still weak and hoarse. "On a hill, in a bend of the river that comes down from Albania." They all looked at me. "I saw it there, the city," I said, "in a dream." Aeneas continued to gaze at me, and his face grew grave and intense.
"I will build your city where you saw it built, Lavinia," he said.
Then he drew back a little, though we both still kept our hands on the pottery vessel. He smiled again and said,
"And did you dream the day of our marriage?"
"No," I whispered.
"Name it, King Latinus," Aeneas said. "Name it soon. Too much time wasted already, too many deaths, too much grief. Let us not be wasteful from now on."
My father did not ponder long.
"The Calends of Quintilis, if the auguries be good."
"They will be,"
Aeneas said. They were, of course. The Trojans had only what was left of June to start their city and build us a house, but they were amazingly hard workers, better disciplined than we Italians, and not used to taking so many holidays. By the first day of the fifth month, the town of Lavinium existed. A bend of the little river Prati half encircled the steep, rocky hill that was the citadel. Around the east and south sides of the hill, sloping downward gently, was a ditch and rampart. Higher up, a wooden palisade showed where the city wall of tufa rock would be built. Within that, the streets were laid out. The main road went up to the citadel with a sharp turn on a steep ramp just before the gate, an excellent defensive position, as all the old soldiers said with satisfaction. A small stone house stood on the hilltop facing the gate, the Regia. That house, the only one completely finished, looked out over the tents and huts and scaffoldings that made up most of the other habitations, and across the palisade to the water meadows of the Prati and the sea dunes a couple of miles to the east. West of the city, the forests of oak and pine rose up and up towards the old volcano, the long mountain, Alba. Early in the morning of that first day of Quintilis, my last day in my father's house, I was arrayed as a bride. I, who had so often ornamented the sacrificial lamb or calf, was now ornamented, and my role, like theirs, was meekness. Festina parted my hair with a bronze spear blade into six tresses, and wound each with red wool fillets. I put on the wreath of good herbs and flowers I'd picked before sunrise in the fields outside town. A woolen sash was tied in a complicated knot round the waist of my tunic. Festina and old Aula, arguing for a long time about exactly how to tie it. And over all went a large, long, light veil, dyed red-orange. It was the flame veil my father's mother, Maritza, had worn when she was married, and her mother before her. Then I joined the three young boys waiting for me in the courtyard, all carrying lighted white thorn torches. The flames were invisible, a mere tremor in the brightness of the midsummer day. Kesis walked in front of me. The other two boys walked beside me, and their mother, Lupina, a respectable townswoman, came behind me as my matron of honor. After us came my father with his counselors and what was left of his guards, and an honor guard of Trojan soldiers sent by Aeneas, and everybody else who wanted to be in the wedding. We went down the Via Regia, and people joined us all along the way, all shouting out the wedding word nobody knows the meaning of, Talasio, Talasio, and throwing nuts about and making dirty jokes. The dirty jokes are part of the marriage ritual, which seemed to surprise the Trojans. There was plenty of time to tell them, since the whole lot of us walked all the way to Lavinium, at least 6 miles. The wedding torches had to be relit or replaced several times, and people got hungry and began eating their walnuts and filberts instead of throwing them about. Water sellers with their tiny, heavy-laden donkeys did a good business all the way. It was strange to me to walk inside the flame veil, looking out at the world through it. All that path I knew so well, all the hills and fields and forests, were a little dim and colored faintly as if with sunset light. I felt set apart from all things, all people, alone, in a way I would never be alone again. When we came at last to the front door of the house on the hill in the new city, Kesis turned round and with a whoop waved his burning torch and threw it end over end as high as he could into the crowd massed behind us. There was a scramble for it and a lot of yelling as people burned their hands grabbing at it to carry off for good luck. Then they all quieted down again and watched me as I rubbed the posts of the doorway with the lump of wolf's fat Festina had carried and given to me to use. It was brownish, stale, with a rank smell. Then she gave me some red wool fillets, and I tied them around the doorposts, murmuring worship to Janus, the doorkeeper. All this time, tall Aeneas stood in the shadow inside the doorway, silent and unmoving, watching me. When I was done, I stood still and looked up at him. He asked the question that is asked. "Who are you?" And I gave the answer that is given. "Where you are Gaius, I am Gaia," Then, with a sudden wide smile, he moved. He picked me up and swung me high over the threshold of our house and set me down inside it. So I was made his wife, the mother of our people, his and mine. As a wife, I never felt that grieving anger that I used to feel and once spoke out to my poet in Albania, asking why must a girl be brought up at home to live as a woman in exile? Indeed, my exile was a small matter, since I went only a few miles from my old home, my father, the dear Regia with its laurel tree, and the lar familiaris of my childhood. But there was more to it than that. Men call women faithless, changeable, and though they say it in jealousy of their own ever-threatened sexual honor, there is some truth in it. We can change our life, our being. No matter what our will is, we are changed. As the moon changes, yet is one, so we are virgin, wife, mother, grandmother. For all their restlessness, men are who they are. Once they put on the man's toga, they will not change again. So they make a virtue of that rigidity and resist whatever might soften it and set them free. But in giving up my girl self and taking on the obligations of womanhood, I found myself freer than I had ever been. If I owed duty to my husband, it was very easy to pay. And as understanding grew between us and we came to trust each other, there were no restraints on me at all but those of religion and my duty to my people. I had grown up with those. They were part of me, not external, not enslaving. Rather, in enlarging the scope of my soul and mind, they liberated me from the narrowness of the single self. I did not bring the Penates of Laurentum with me. My father had manumitted his slave, Maruna's mother, to be their servant and guardian in my place. When I first entered my new house in Aeneas' arms, the Penates of his father's house in Troy stood on the altar at the back of the atrium. They were the gods of this house now, my family's gods, and I was their servant and guardian. A very old bowl of thin silver, worn and dented, stood near them, ready for the sacred meal. The lamps were of polished black clay. On our dining table was a plate painted red and black, and on it was a little mound of dried fava beans, the food that must always stand on the table for the gods who share it with us, and near it the salt cellar, all as it should be. And on the hearth, Vesta, the holy fire, burned small and clear. Aeneas was about twice my age when we married. When I first saw his whole body, all muscle and sinew and bone and scar, I thought of the lean splendor of a wolf Aelmo and his brothers had caught and kept caged for a while before they killed it as a sacrifice to Mars. Aeneas' body had been made in a hard school, but the man was no wolf, nor a hard man. I knew he had loved two women before me and grieved for them both. Although he knew me first only as an item in a treaty, he was disposed by nature and by practice to treat me as a wife, intimate to his own being. At first, I think my youth awed him. He was afraid of hurting me. He praised my beauty with incredulous delight. He honored my ignorance, but I was impatient with it and ready to learn from him, as he soon learned. As often as we made love, I remembered what my poet told me, that this man was born of a goddess, the force that moves the stars and the waves of the sea and couples the animals in the fields in spring, the power of passion, the light of the evening star. I cannot tell much in detail of the 3 years of our marriage, for my mind holds me back from speaking much of those doings and undertakings that seemed of such importance to us and filled our days so full. And indeed they were important both to us and to our people, and they have filled my life, not only then, but ever since, completing me, so that though I knew the bitter grief of widowhood, I seldom felt the utter emptiness. I think if you have lost a great happiness and try to recall it, you are only asking for sorrow. But if you do not try to dwell on the happiness, sometimes you find it dwelling in your heart and body, silent but sustaining. The purest, completest happiness I know is that of a baby at the breast and the mother giving suck. From that I know what perfect fulfillment is. But I cannot regain it by remembering, by speaking, by yearning. To have known it is enough and all. I knew how little time Aeneas had to live, and he did not. Or I think he did not. I do not know all the prophecies he may have heard during his voyage, or when he went among the shadows. If he did know, the knowledge did not weigh on him, or make him shorten his view, or shrink his hope at all. He looked forward fearlessly, and sought to shape the time to come. He was a man building a city, founding a nation, working in every way he could for the well-being of his people, his family, himself. His shield hung in our entrance hall, full of images of the time to come, the kings, the templed hills, the heroes and their wars. He had carried the future of his people on his shoulder into war. Now he meant to found that future in peace. After 10 years of war in Troy, war had met him again, unlooked for, unwanted, here on the Italian shore. He wanted never to meet it again. He was determined to make an enduring peace, as Latinus had done. His first and strongest purpose was to establish the rule of law, the custom of negotiation and arbitration, the superiority of rational patience over mindless violence among his Trojans and the Latins who were building Lavinium with them, and among all our neighboring peoples. It did not take me long to realize, as the first year passed, how his mind dwelt on the ending of the brief war here in Italy, how that had shaken and reshaped all his idea of who he was and what his duty was. Not the war itself. That had been unavoidable. Once Mars rules men, Mars must be obeyed on his own terms. It was the ending of it that weighed on Aeneas, the manner of Turnus' death. To him, that put all the rest into question. He saw it as a murder. He saw himself as a murderer. He had withheld his sword, giving Turnus time to surrender to him fully and courageously. And yet, after that, dismissing the obligation to spare the helpless and pardon the conquered, in a fury of vengeance, he had killed him. He had done Nephas unspeakable wrong. We talked in the summer mornings before we got to work. We talked in darkness, in our marriage bed, in the lengthening autumn nights. He learned that he could talk to me as I think he had never talked to anyone, unless perhaps Creusa, long ago, in the dark years of the siege of Troy when he was young. He was a man who thought hard and constantly about what he had done and what he ought to do. And his active conscience welcomed my listening, my silence, and my attempts to answer, as it struggled for clarity. And my ignorance welcomed his questioning, which taught me what is worth asking. "You were angry," I said. "You should have been. First Turnus challenged you. Then he deliberately ran away from you, kept you chasing him, knowing you'd been wounded, to wear you out. It was a coward's tactic." "If it was a tactic, all's fair in war."
"But he broke the truce."
"It wasn't his doing. He let his sister talk, and Camers, and that Tolumnius, who threw the spear. Believe me, I have no regret at all for killing Tolumnius. But Turnus didn't speak, then or later, not till the end. He acted like a man under a spell."
"That's what Seristus said," I said. "The owl he saw, just before you met with Turnus. He said he doesn't know if he saw an owl flying around Turnus' head, beating at him with its wings, or if he saw something Turnus was seeing that wasn't actually there." I could feel Aeneas shudder slightly. He did not speak. After a long time, I said, "I think there was some evil in Turnus' heritage. In my mother's family, something frantic, a madness, a darkness. It ran in their blood like a black snake, a fire without light. Oh, may the powers of all goodness and the Earth Mother and my Juno keep it from me and our child." I knew by then that I had conceived, and I too shuddered as I spoke, and held to Aeneas for courage. He soothed me, stroking my hair. "There is no evil in you," he said.
You are as clear of soul as the springs of the Numicus, up there in the hills, as pure and clear. But I thought of the springs of Albania, silent, pallid under their stinking bluish mist.
Turnus was young, ambitious, impatient, he said. But what was evil in him?
His greed, I said at once. Greed, selfishness, self, self. He saw the world only as what he wanted from it. He killed the Greek boy for his sword belt, and killed him cruelly, and boasted about it. That was what you couldn't bear, seeing that belt on his shoulder.
I killed the Etruscan boy, Lausus, cruelly.
You didn't boast about it.
No, I grieved about it. What good did that do? He was dead.
But Aeneas, nobody spared anybody in that battle, not even when they begged for their lives. You said so. Later, I remembered that it was not Aeneas who had told me that, but the poet. But neither Aeneas nor I noticed at the time, and I went on, eloquent in my desire to spare him his anguish. You were fighting to the death, not just you and Turnus, but all of you. It doesn't matter if you were crazy with bloodlust or cold as seawater. You did what you had to do. Pallas tried to kill Turnus, and so Turnus killed him. Lausus tried to kill you, and so you killed him. Turnus tried to kill you, and so you killed him. It was a challenge to the death between you two. Nothing else could have ended the war. That is the order. The farce of war, isn't it? And you obeyed it. You did what you had to do, what had to be done, as you always do. He said nothing for a while, and then very little. I thought he was struck by my argument. He was stricken by it. It was only much later that I saw I had taken from him the self-blame that allowed him some self-justification. If he could not see his battle rage as the enemy of his piety, as fury for a moment overcoming his better self. If he could not see his killing Turnus as a fatal instant of disorder, then he had to see the fury as part of his true nature, part of the right order of things, the order he had spent his life trying to uphold, serve, preserve. If that order held his killing Turnus to be a righteous act, was it itself righteous? Turnus' death ensured the victory of Aeneas' cause, but it was a mortal defeat for the man Aeneas. As he struck, Aeneas had called the killing a sacrifice. But of what? To what? I did not know what kind of courage I was asking of my patient hero. We did not speak again of the matter. I went on thinking that I had unburdened his mind of an unnecessary guilt, comforted him, relieved him of the need for courage. Young wives can be great fools. Our city grew up around our little Regia so quickly that it sometimes seemed unreal, a vision, like my dream of it. But to look out from our door and see the thatch and tile roofs all around and smell the cooking smoke from them rising and hear the voices of the people, a young Latin wife calling to her Trojan husband, a workman shouting to his helper, a child singing a jumping game song. That was all real, every morning and evening, and vivid and cheerful. Lavinium looked much like any other city of our coast, though its citadel stood higher than many, on its ridge of tufa over the little dark river Prati. Left to themselves, the Trojans might have built the houses differently, but the carpenters were Italians and did things the way they always did things. And I insisted that every tree within the walls that could be left standing should stand. The Trojans thought that odd at first, but they admitted the virtues of shade in midsummer and came to take pride in the oak or laurel or willow grove that sheltered their house. We had less shade than most in the Regia, but I had brought a scion of the laurel of my father's house in our courtyard, and in a year it was already above our heads. And we planted a wild grapevine to climb out over a lattice and shade the south end of the courtyard. There were a great many weddings that first year. Not many Trojan women had come from Sicily on this last leg of the long retreat from Troy. The men were eager to take a wife wherever they could find one. By winter, there was hardly an unmarried girl left in Latium, and unmarried Latin men complained about it copiously. My Silvius was the first baby born in Lavinium. But before that May was over, there were 5 more little Trojan Latins wailing in cradles around town, and the powers that attend childbirth were busy all that year and the years that followed. Local families that acquired Trojan sons-in-law were drawn to the city by the bonds of kinship, and workmen came attracted by the need for their crafts. Many of them settled down, liking the new town and its king. Before long, there were more Latins than Trojans in Lavinium. The hardy warriors who had come so far with Aeneas found themselves living as Italian householders among Italian householders, farming beside the native farmers, their great city a legend, their noble lineage meaningless, and all their battles, adventures, storms, and voyages sunk in daily domesticity at the fireside of a small house in a small city in a foreign land. It was hard for some of them, the younger ones particularly. The men over 30 were mostly glad to be done with hardship and salt water, to have a hearth of their own and a bed with a wife in it. But Aeneas kept an eye on the men in their teens and 20s, giving them the hardest work to do. Anything dangerous in any way was for them, and he kept up a series of drills and athletic games in which they competed for championship in one skill or sport after another, while older men and children looked on and cheered. Young Latins were welcome to these games, and many joined in them with strong competitive spirit. There were various Trojan holy days to be marked by games, and Aeneas added every Latin festival he could to the calendar, so the young men were always in training for one event or another. My stepson, Ascanius, had learned to ride in Africa and was an excellent horseman, usually taking the lead in any displays of riding and training. In other sports, archery, racing, leaping, wrestling, throwing the stone, or military drills with sword and spear, he was not naturally among the best, but he thought he ought to be and drove himself desperately to excel. When he came in 6th or 5th or even 2nd, he was angry and ashamed and would dispute the judgment or go off scowling to berate himself. If he was not the huntsman who killed the boar or stag, he came home from hunting sad and sullen. He had his father's seriousness and sense of duty, but not his sense of proportion or his patient strength. Their young prince had naturally been the darling of the exiled Trojans during their wanderings, and I think when they were in Carthage, the queen had spoiled him, for he was always talking about what Dido had let him do and how splendid it had been in Africa. If he noticed how his father's face darkened at such talk, he never asked why. With me, only a few years older than he was wary and reserved. I could not be the cherishing mother he had lost. I seemed to him, and even to myself, more like an elder sister, a powerful rival for the father's love. He was jealous of his baby half-brother. No father could have loved a son more than Aeneas loved Ascanius, but Ascanius had not yet grown into the generosity of heart that would let him simply accept that love. He thought he had to earn it by proving himself superior to it. He was restless and unhappy, and his unhappiness troubled his father. Fortunately, he loved hunting, and so he was sent with a hunting party up into the mountains as often as he liked. Our flocks and herds were not yet plentiful, and game was a great treat for us. Ascanius could feel himself needed, a hero, worthy of his father, when he strode in with a feast's worth of meat and a bearskin, the rack of a great stag, or the tusks of a mountain boar as trophy. My son Silvius was born the day after the May Calends, a little early by our calculations, not a large baby, but a fine one. Even when his little red face was as flat and slant-eyed as a kitten's, I could see his father's features latent in it. The strong brow line and eminent nose. He smiled unmistakably at less than a month old, and wept real tears soon after. Again, taking after his father, a good-humored man easily moved to tears. Silvius sucked insatiably, had almost no colic, slept a great deal, and when awake, was wide awake and full of good cheer. There is not much you can say about a baby unless you are talking with its father or another mother or nurse. Infants are not part of the realm of ordinary language. Talk is inadequate to them as they are inadequate to talk. Silvius was a fine baby and gave his mother and father infinite delight. Let that suffice.
There was not much hard feeling against Aeneas' people among the people of Latium. As the Latins saw it now, they had been used by the Rutulians to fight a war that was more in Turnus' interest than theirs. They had been humiliated and were glad to put it all behind them. My father, Latinus, was held in more honor now than ever, as his people saw his effort to keep the peace justified and his prophecies fulfilled. He welcomed their goodwill, but he was a man bereft of joy in life. His health often failed. The war, brief as it was, had made him old. More and more often he called for Aeneas to come up to Laurentum, or came to Lavinium to advise and consult with him on matters of government and land use, decisions about planting, harvesting, trade. He made it clear that Aeneas was his son, the next king of Latium, and that his counselors must keep Aeneas' favor or lose his. He was immensely generous to us, opening up his royal lands to our farmers, stocking our pastures with the best of his own flocks and herds, so that Lavinium could grow and flourish from the start. Within a couple of years, the new town was drawing people away from the old one. People said to one another, "Things are lively down there on the Prati. What if we set up shop there?" So Laurentum began slowly to become the town it now is, a very small, sleepy, silent place, its gate unguarded, the neglected houses shaded by immense trees. No one at all in the Regia but a few old guards and their wives and slaves to care for the house gods and sit spinning by the pool under the great laurel. If most of the Latins kept no grudge against Aeneas' people, old Tyrus did, and his one son who had survived the war, and his daughter Sylvia. They did not forgive the Trojans, would never forgive them. The old man defied Latinus openly, calling him a coward who'd sold his kingdom and his daughter to a foreign adventurer. "Why don't you Latins rise up and drive out the usurpers?" he shouted. "Look what the king is doing, giving away our cattle to these robbers." Latinus let him shout, let him keep his position as royal herdsman, did not punish or reprove him at all. That shocked people like Drances, who said the king endangered his dignity and power by permitting treasonous speech. But Latinus ignored Drances as well as Tyrus. Since his rant brought about no response, people came to dismiss Tyrus as only a bitter old man, raving in his unassuageable grief. As for Drances, Aeneas trusted him no more than I did. He and Latinus let him talk, and let his talk die away into nothing. The stag Servulus that Ascanius shot did not die of the wound, but lived on some years, lame and timid, always staying close to the farmhouse. So people in Laurentum told me. I sent to Sylvia once to ask if I might visit. She sent me no reply. Cowardice kept me from going there. I was afraid the old man would rage at me and insult my husband. I was afraid Sylvia would turn her back on me. She married late, a cousin who had come to help her father and brother with the herds. So she never left her own Penates, but lived all her life on the home farm. I never saw her again. Outside Latium, among our allied and neighbor kingdoms, the war had left hard feelings and sore hearts. Every people that had sent warriors to aid Turnus had seen them limp home beaten, their kings and captains dead. The conduct of the war itself had been so erratic, a treaty no sooner made than broken, then remade, then broken again in the making. And its aims had been so unclear that they hardly knew who was to blame. It was easy to lay it to Turnus' ambition, but then Latinus had allowed his people to fight alongside Turnus as if it had truly been an alliance of Italians to drive the foreigners out, and the Volscian and Sabine kings and captains had been slaughtered not by Italians, but by Trojans, Etruscans, Greeks. Everybody knew the Etruscans were seeking dominion over the southern states. Greeks were never to be trusted. And who were these Trojans who had sailed in, claiming all Italy as their inheritance? For word of that prophecy had got out. Though Aeneas never spoke of it in public, some of his people did. They told how he had brought them here, guided by omens and oracles, to rule the whole country, to found a glorious, everlasting empire. Ascanius talked about it to the Latin youths, who were now his intimates. He brought them into our atrium to show them Aeneas' shield with its mysterious foreshadowings of mighty buildings and endless wars. "Those warriors, those kings, are my descendants," he said to his friends. As he spoke, I passed by, carrying little Silvius on my shoulder, as Aeneas had carried the shield. In the second spring, late in Mars month, a band of Rutulians and Volscians met in secret outside Erdia, and coming across country at night made an early morning assault on Lavinium. Our walls were built solid by then, but they were not guarded against attack. Closed at nightfall, the city gate was opened before dawn to let shepherds and herdsmen in and out with their animals. Our first warning was a couple of farm boys who came pelting up the ramp, shouting, "An army! An army is coming!" The gatekeeper set up the alarm. In an emergency, Aeneas moved like a cat. He was up and outside, calling to Ascanius and Achates, Seristus and Menestheus, to get the men together under arms before I understood anything at all. When I went up on our roof to look out over the walls and saw the mob of men drifting across the fields like a dark cloud shot through with the gleam of spear points, swift and almost silent, terror gripped me. It was war again. It was Mars coming again to break down the doors. Blood and death and ruin. The end of everything. I held Silvius close to my breast, crouching so that we were sheltered by the roof parapet, and moaned like a hurt dog. I had lost the courage of virginity. I was a cowering, weak-kneed woman like the rest of them, fearful for my child and my man. Fortunately, Maruna was not. Just as when we had thought Laurentum was to stand siege, she began to speak to me about supplies, water, wood for the cook fires, and so brought me out of my fit of cowardice. I went down with her and said the morning prayers, and then saw to what was to be done. The attackers never got into the city. Our men poured out of the gate to meet them, Aeneas and his old captains at their head, the Trojans and the young athletes armed with sword and shield, spear or lance, and the householders brandishing hoes, mattocks, scythes, and sickles. The two mobs met face to face on the outer wall of the encircling earthworks, where they fought savagely but briefly. Several young archers up on the gate tower shot at the attackers as they scattered, turned, and fled. Most of our men gave chase, some of them stopping to catch a horse from the herds kept in the near paddocks. But Aeneas brought his Trojans and all the young men he could back into the city. I was waiting in front of the house as he came up the street with his troops and turned to talk to them.
"How's that for a lively start to the day?" he said,
in his voice that you could hear through all the other voices, even when he spoke quietly, and they all laughed and cheered.
"I think they've had their lesson," he went on. "We're in a good position to practice restraint. The less men they lose, the less revenge they'll need to take. The whole thing can be quickly forgotten. Who was leading them? Did anyone see?"
"Camirs," several Latin voices answered. "Young Camirs of Erdia."
"Well, they won't be apt to follow him again soon. Were they all Rutulians?"
He could not yet tell peoples and tribes from one another as we natives could. But even if he had identified the attackers, he might have asked for information. He knew that people liked to be asked, liked to be the ones who know.
"Volscians. There was a whole crowd of Volscians,"
the Latins called, with various descriptions of Volscian character and anatomy.
"Them with horses' arses on their hats," one man shouted.
The townsmen were excited, elated with their sudden, easy victory. Small wounds were exhibited proudly. Householders and young men came back with trophies of enemies they had chased down and killed or forced to surrender, breastplates, swords, helmets. Lavinium was a noisy city all that day and night, and a lot of green wine was drunk. Aeneas was genial with the boastful revelers, keeping open house at the Regia for them till very late.
"It's brought them together," he said to me as we stood apart from the crowd near the women's side before I went to bed. "My people and yours. They're all Lavinians now. Since this had to happen, it happened fortunately."
"But is it going to go on and on?" I asked him stupidly. "Will it happen again and again?" The awful fear I had felt that morning had never left me,
It was like a thin, narrow coldness in my bones. He looked at me with the eyes that had seen his city burn, that had seen the world of the dead. He held me gently.
Yes, he said. But I will keep as much of it from happening as I can, Lavinia.
He was able to stave off most of it for a while. The rout of the would-be besiegers sent a clear message that Lavinium could defend itself, and he followed up on that with energetic efforts to strengthen our alliances with the Sabines, with Kyri and other cities of Etruria, and with King Evander in Palantium. Evander, still sunk in grief for his son, held Aeneas responsible for not protecting the boy in battle. His welcome to our visit was reluctant. I had not been there since my visit with my father, when Pallas and I were children. It was very sad to see the little settlement grown poorer, the houses settling into the mud of the riverbank, the women and children looking thin and weary. I looked around in wonder, for this was the place where my poet had said the great city of our descendants was to be. Among the thickets up on those rough hills were to stand the shining palaces and altars pictured on the shield. Great crowds, great rulers, were to walk on marble pavement here, between the thatched huts and the wolf's deserted cave, where a few lean cattle wandered seeking forage. Aeneas was in a heavy mood that night when we were alone in the room given us in Evander's low, dark house. Evander's sorrowful rancor was hard for him to bear. Seeking some way to cheer him, and with my head full of those images, I said, "You said I have a gift for knowing where to build a city," for he had often praised my choice of the site of Lavinium.
"Yes, you do."
"Well, this is the best site of all." He looked at me from under his brows, waiting. "I saw it in, call it a dream." I had never come so close before to speaking of the poet to him, and felt I was treading on a dangerous edge, but I went on cautiously. "The city on your shield, the great city." He nodded. "It will be here, just here, and up on those hills, the seven hills. I think it will be called by one of the Father River's sacred names. The Etruscans say Ruma, we say Roma. It will be the greatest city in the world." I looked over at the baby, who was sound asleep in his travel basket. "Full of little Silviuses," I said, "thousands of them." After a moment, he smiled.
"Lucky town," he said. "You saw this?"
"On your shield, mostly."
"You know how to read it," he said thoughtfully. "I never have."
"Guesses, dreams." He stood over the baby's basket, brooding, and presently reached down and stroked the soft, wispy hair with the back of his forefinger.
"You'll carry it,"
he whispered to the baby. "Let it not be in battle," I said.
"Wherever he must. Come then, my dear. We'll sleep in the great city tonight."
Evander's alliance was grudging, and he had not much assistance to offer us. But word of our friendship with the Greeks of Palantium reached the Greeks at Erpa, a much larger and wealthier colony in the southeast, ruled by a man Aeneas had known long ago and far away, Diomedes, a Greek captain at the siege of Troy. There was little cause for love between them. Achates told me why. Aeneas himself never talked about the war with the Greeks. In combat, in the last year of the siege, Diomedes had killed Aeneas' charioteer, and while Aeneas stood over the body to save it from the Greek looters, Diomedes brought him down with the throw of a great stone, hitting him in the hip joint, bringing him to his knees. Diomedes' sword was raised for the death stroke, when Aeneas threw dust up into his eyes and got away, an escape so unexpected it was uncanny, and added a good deal to Aeneas' reputation as a fighter. Diomedes, furious, went looking for him through the battle. When he finally found him, lamed, he rushed at him to kill him. But the great fighter, Hector, came to Aeneas' defense, bringing the whole Trojan line back into battle around him. Achates told me this story when we were discussing the Greeks and their colonies.
I told him in turn how Diomedes had refused to join Turnus' alliance, warning Turnus to beware of Aeneas, for he was under the protection of great powers. Achates nodded and said,
"A wise man, Diomedes. Wiser than he was, anyhow. He used to be a great brawler. He'd take on god or man. I wouldn't mind seeing him again after all these years."
And not long after we returned from Palantium, an envoy arrived from Aerpa with a gift of 10 fine mares and a proposal from Diomedes of an alliance between his people and the Latins, under their kings Latinus and Aeneas. Latinus was entirely in favor. He said,
Go on down there and seal a treaty with the man. That puts the Rutulians and Volscians between him and us. In the nutcracker.
There's a saying, Aeneas said. Keep an eye on Greeks when they offer gifts.
He spoke wryly, horses particularly.
I'll keep the horses then, my father said. You go make the speeches.
He was in a mellow mood that summer. His health had improved, and he had come to Lavinium several times to do worship at the altar of his grandson, as he said. Aeneas did not take me down to Aerpa with him. It was a long way through unsafe country, and he was not sure if he could trust Diomedes. I worried about him while he was gone, but not very much. It was only the second summer. It was not time to worry yet. He and his well-armed troop of companions came back safe and sound after 20 days. He said he and Diomedes had a good talk and fought the whole Trojan War over. They had sealed a treaty of peace and assistance at the altar with the sacrifice of 10 boars, 10 oxen, and 10 rams, for Diomedes was rich. On the way home, the last night out, Aeneas spent the night at the Alban Mountain.
That's a sacred place if I ever saw one, he said. It made me think of Mount Ida. But nobody lives there.
It is sacred. Father's been there for the winter solstice, when a gap in the rim of the crater points to the sun. And when there's drought or rain out of season, or if lightning strikes somebody dead, people go to Alba to pray and worship. I don't know why it's empty. Maybe the land's not good.
There's a village up by the lake, they said, but there ought to be a real town there. The soil is pale, though.
It's white ash, Ascanius said. Ash is good for vines.
Aeneas went north early in the autumn to Kyri by ship, taking with him as fine a gift as we could offer Tarchon and his people for their help in the war. 3 white bulls, 3 white rams, and a pair of stallion colts with gray coats that would whiten as they aged. The horses had splendid gear of gilt leather and gilt bronze, given by my father. It was not a mighty gift for 2 kings to give, but it was fitting to our present status. There was no use our pretending to equal the Etruscans in wealth or power or the arts of living. They knew it, and we knew it. They made Aeneas welcome in Kyri, and he stayed over a month in Etruria, visiting Falerii and Veii, well received everywhere. He sailed home pleased with his journey. I did not want to spoil his pleasure, but when we were in our room away from everyone else, and I could speak my mind, I burst out,
"Oh, never go away again for so long, Aeneas, I beg you, never go away again at all."
And to my surprise, I began to cry. Of course, he soothed me and quieted me and asked what had worried me. And of course I could not tell him that only this winter and the next summer and the next winter were left to us together. I said, "I know you have to make these journeys, but maybe you can put them off till later, when Silvius is 1 or 2 older. Not this year, no more traveling this year, or even 2 years, and not for so long, not for a whole month."
It made no sense to him. How could it?
He worked at it, and finally said all he could possibly say.
"I won't travel unless I must, Lavinia."
I nodded, trying to repress my weeping, and hot and red with shame at my weakness and my efforts to deceive our fate.
"I cannot bear to see you cry," he said.
His own eyes were full of tears.